Chapter 7. It was late by the time Steele's chopper landed on his penthouse helipad. There had been no further sign of Stalker. After hitting the dragons, he had simply disappeared, most likely back into the warren of subway tunnels hidden underneath the city. It would have been impossible to search them all. There were tunnels down there they didn't even know about. And with the acoustics down there, a body of men would make too much noise no matter how quietly they tried to move. The best they could do for now was to patrol the old subway entrances and seal up as many of them as possible. Steele left word to be summoned the moment Stalker was spotted again and went back to his penthouse where the shift had changed. He wasn't physically tired and he didn't really need to sleep, though his mental engrams were psychologically conditioned to it. He felt emotionally drained and he badly needed to know if any leads had been turned up in Corey's case. He found Ice and Raven waiting for him. Jason was awake as well. He looked a little better, but his battered face looked tired and drawn. Poor kid, thought Steele. He's growing up hard and fast before his time.
Any luck?
Asked Raven. Steele shook his head. No! He's still out there somewhere, laying low for now. What about you?
The news ain't good,
said Ice.
He found out where Corey was,
said Raven.
Was,
said Steele, tensing.
Jason identified the pimp who beat him up,
said Raven.
It was Rico.
Rico, Steele said. Not that same psycho who turned you over to the skulls.
Raven nodded.
Jesus Christ, Steele said. I should have taken care of that bastard after what he did to you! Only I didn't! And now...
Don't blame yourself,
said Raven.
You never had the chance. You had your hands full with the Borodinis. Anyway, it's all come back full circle.
What do you mean? Where is she?
Rick Borodini's got her,
she said. Steele stared at them. He had a hollow feeling in the pit of his stomach, as if the bottom had dropped out of it.
Rico used to be hooked up with Tommy B,
said Ice.
I went over there to get your little girl and found out he'd taken her to Rick. She must have told him who she be. I called Hardesty. He sent some people over there, but Rico never showed. We've been waiting here, figuring Borodini would call with some kind of demand, but there ain't been no word.
Steele lowered himself into a chair and closed his eyes.
They're going to use her to get back at me.
What do you mean? Said Jason with concern. They're not going to hurt her.
I don't know,
Steele said. He sounded dazed. He rubbed his forehead wearily.
If it was Tommy Borodini, I wouldn't put it past him, but Rick's different. I'm the one they want. They'll most likely use her for a bargaining chip.
The phone rang. Jason lunged for it.
Steele residence,
he said tensely.
Jason, is that you?
Yes. Chief Hardesty?
That's right! How you feeling, kid?
Better, thanks. You want to talk to Dad?
Yeah! Put him on!
Steele took the phone.
Jake, any news?
Rico's car was found down in Times Square. He was inside, shot twice through the head. Looks like they took him out and dumped him so he couldn't let us know where the Borodinis are.
At least we know they're somewhere in the city and not out on the island,
Steele said.
If they were out there, you never would have found him. Car turn up any clues?
Not so far,
said Hardesty.
But we're checking it out over just the same. Have you heard from Borodini?
Not yet.
Well, this may be something. I've checked out all calls going out from Rico's place. We got one that sticks out like a sore thumb, addressed down on Canal Street.
That's in no man's land on the south end,
said Steele.
Yeah, not too many places down there. I sent some units down to check it out.
Give me the address. I'll meet them down there.
I'd rather you stay put,
said Hardesty.
Stalker's still out there somewhere. Let my people handle this.
Damn it, Jake! We're talking about my daughter!
I know, and you should be there in case Borodini calls. Besides, we don't know that Corey's be down there. If she is, we'll get her. If not, I'll let you know right away.
Steele sighed.
All right, but for God's sake, tell them to be careful.
They will. They know it's family. I better get off the phone. We put a tracer on your line, just in case Borodini gets in touch. Try to keep him talking. I'll get back to you as soon as I know anything.
Okay, Jake. Thanks.
He hung up the phone.
What is it?
Raven said.
Rico's dead, said Steele. They found his body in his car, abandoned in Times Square.
Look like Ricky B saved me the trouble,
Ice said.
Rico called someplace down on Canal Street, Steele said. Jake sent out some units down to check it out.
I'll keep my fingers crossed,
said Raven. Steele glanced at his son.
Jason, have you called your mother?
No, I was waiting for Corey to get back.
You'd better call her, Steele said. I promised to let her know if either one of you turned up. She's worried about you. You should let her know you're safe.
Oh, she'll only want me to go back, said Jason.
And that's exactly what you should do, Steele said.
Jason looked stung.
You don't want me here?
That isn't it, son. But your mother's got legal custody. I can't keep you here against her wishes. Besides, with things the way they are, I'd be much happier knowing you were safe with her.
I'm not going back without Corey!
You'll do what I tell you!
Steele snapped. It suddenly got very quiet in the room. Steele sighed, regretting his outburst. He was under a lot of stress, but that was no reason to take it out on the kid.
Look, Jason, you can send me back,
Jason said defiantly, but you can't make me stay. Corey needs me. I'm the one she always came to when things went wrong, because I was the one who was always there for her.
She could never talk to Mom. Mom didn't want to hear about the things going wrong. And most of the time, you just weren't there.
Steele winced.
And when you were there, she could never talk to you because of Mom. You think we didn't know what was going on. The two of you could hardly talk to one another without fighting, he said bitterly. And then you try to make up with each other, only it would never last. And there was never any time for us. Not like it used to be. Oh, sure, there were the family get-togethers, like when we go visit Grandma. But the two of you were never just going through the motions. It's like if it wasn't for us, the two of you would have split up a long time ago. You think we didn't know that? You think we didn't care?
Jason, you don't understand.
Don't I? Fine, then you explain it to me. You explain all the times that you didn't come home. Explain about the times the phone rang when you weren't around and one of us would pick it up and they'd hang up on us. Explain about the times Mom would pick up the phone and say she couldn't talk now. What do you think, we were stupid? And we didn't see what was going on? All Corey and I ever had was each other. Maybe it wasn't all we ever wanted, but it was what we had. And now Corey's in a lot of trouble, and I'm the one she called for help. If you won't let me stay here and help her get back, I'll do it myself somehow. But I'm not going back without her.
He was close to tears. To avoid breaking down in front of him, he went back to the bedroom and slammed the door. Steele simply stood there, staring after him, still feeling the sting of the boy's words.
I guess I didn't handle that too well, he said.
No, you didn't,
Raven said quietly.
Kid got a lot of guts,
said Ice. He turned to Steele.
Maybe Jason not a man yet, but he ain't no little boy either. Ain't no use treating him like one.
He got up.
I going down, get me some shut-eye. Call me anything goes down.
Steele grimaced and went out over to the bar to pour himself a drink.
You want one?
He asked Raven.
Sure, why not?
She said.
Sometimes I wish I was capable of getting drunk, he said, pouring their drinks. I feel so goddamn helpless.
You're doing all you can,
she said.
Maybe, but it's not enough. Not nearly enough.
He sat down beside her. She moved closer to him.
They're good kids, Raven. They deserved a lot better than this. A lot better. It seems like anyone who gets near me winds up getting hurt.
Blaming yourself's not going to help them,
she said.
Very few people get what they deserve, both good and bad. You play the cards you get, and you try to make the best of it.
She's such a sweet kid,
he said, his voice sounding hollow.
What's going to happen to her?
She'll get through it,
Raven said.
If she's anything like her brother, or like her old man, she'll make it.
I hope so, Steele said dully. I pray to God she does, but she'll be scarred for life by this.
I know,
said Raven.
She'll need a lot of help. I wish there was something I could say to make you feel better, but words ain't gonna help. This is a very heavy scene. Still, for what it's worth, she'll probably be much better off with the Borodinis than with Rico.
It's not worth much, but I suppose it's worth something, Steele said. I'm glad that son of a bitch is dead. I only wish I'd been the one who killed him,
he sighed.
On the other hand, if Rico was still alive, we'd know where Corey is now.
The phone rang. Steele grabbed it up.
Steele!
It's Jake Steele,
said Hardesty.
Did you find her?
Bad news, I'm afraid. We busted the warehouse, but Corey wasn't there. Neither were the Borodinis. We just got some small fry.
But they know where Borodini is, said Steele. I'll be right down. I'll make the bastards talk.
Forget it,
Hardesty said.
Their lawyers are already here. Besides, I don't think they know where Borodini is. We grilled them pretty good, but they're nothing but hired muscle. The old man is a cagey bastard. I doubt anyone besides Rick and Polly and a few trusted soldiers who are with him know where he's hiding out. We've got some units stationed at the warehouse, just in case, but they won't be coming back. The news media sniffed out the bus somehow, and they've already blown the story.
Goddamn reporters!
Tell me about it. They've been on my ass about Stalker around the clock. Especially that Tellerman woman. I've given them everything I know, but they're still convinced I'm holding out on them. And when your man Higgins found out that I was talking to the press, he just about had a coronary. He threatened me with charges, but I told him you'd authorized it. He wasn't very happy. The media's been on his ass as well. I haven't left the office since this whole thing started. I've been catching catnaps on a fucking cot. Have you heard anything from Ricky B?
No, nothing. Steele said.
How's the kid holding up?
He's under a lot of strain, but he's hanging tough, said Steele.
Anything you want me to do?
No, I guess you've already done all you could, said Steele with resignation. Any word of Stalker?
Nothing. I don't know if that's good or bad.
Neither do I, said Steele.
Steele, look, I...
Hardesty hesitated.
What is it, Jake?
Look! What are the odds that Stalker might just break down or something?
I don't know, Jake. I can't give you the odds on that any more than I give you the odds on whether or not I'll start malfunctioning. Stalker and I are both experimental prototypes. The only man who might have been able to answer that question was Dr. Philip Gates. Only he's dead.
Yeah, well, I just figured I'd ask. He'd save us all a lot of trouble if he self-destructed somehow. But I guess that would only give you something new to worry about. I'm sorry. I should have brought it up.
Forget about it. It'll probably get worse before it gets better.
I'm afraid you're right. You holding up okay?
Yeah, I was designed to. Unfortunately, so was Stalker. Get some rest, Jake.
He hung up the phone.
I'd better go look in on Jason, he said. Tell him I'm sorry. Not that that's going to fix anything.
It might,
said Raven, smiling. Steele opened the door of the guest bedroom. Jason was lying on the bed. He was fast asleep, but his face was still damp with the tracks of his tears. Steele stared at his son for a long moment, then softly closed the door. Higgins had spent the night on the couch in his office. He was tired from lack of sleep, but when he checked, he found that Jennifer Stone was already been working since 5 o'clock that morning. He debated going down to see her, then decided to leave word for her to stop by his office whenever she had a chance. The two of them needed to talk. They hadn't spoken much afterward. In the aftermath of the passion that overcame them both, there had been an awkward embarrassment, with neither of them really knowing what to say. After all, they barely knew each other. He spent most of the day coordinating with the agents he had sent out to assist the task force searching for Stalker, but they weren't making much progress. What they did have to report was hardly encouraging. Stalker had organized a bunch of savage derelicts and had hit one of the gangs, seizing a large cache of weapons. The media found out about it, and they were having a field day with the story.
City under siege, renegade cyborg on the loose, authorities helpless.
To make matters even worse, Chief Hardesty had been talking to the press. In direct disobedience to orders, Steele had authorized him to give out the information on the theory that they needed all the help they could get from an alert and informed citizenry. Maybe he was right, Higgins thought with resignation. Steele had his own way of doing things. He was insubordinate as hell, but he always got results. And maybe it was better to cooperate with the media up front than have them get wind of it on their own and start screaming, "Cover up!" But the result was that Higgins had to spend most of the day doing a great deal of explaining to his superiors, who were being pressured by angry members of the legislature. There was talk of scuttling the project. Higgins spent most of the day on the phone, playing every card he had, but the most he could achieve was a compromise. They would put the project on indefinite hold, which meant no more allocations from the committee, which meant no more budget, which meant that after this year's resources ran out, if the committee did not vote to continue with the project, the whole thing would be history. And as if he didn't have enough problems, throughout the entire day, he had not been able to get Jennifer Stone out of his mind. Nothing like that had ever happened to him before. Contrary to the old glamorous image of secret agents, Higgins had never been a playboy. He'd always been very conservative and old-fashioned when it came to personal relationships. In his line of work, he had to be. He had never become intimate with anyone he didn't know extremely well. He had a file on Jennifer Stone, but being thoroughly familiar with it was not the same as knowing her, and there were significant gaps in it when it came to her personal life. He sat in his office looking over her file once more, as if there could be something in it that could help him understand what had occurred the previous night. Since the war, intelligence gathering capabilities weren't what they used to be. In a well-organized society, intelligence gathering was vastly simplified, but they no longer lived in a well-organized society. The one they lived in was severely crippled. Many people's lives were no longer thoroughly documented. Consequently, there were limits to what even the CIA could learn. Outside of the core cities, birth records were scarce or completely non-existent. Educational records were spotty at best. Records of employment were not always available. Society was too busy trying to survive to bother keeping records. Where the government retained any semblance of control, there were such things as taxation and voter registration, personnel records and social services, school and hospital records, and other things through which a person's life could be traced to at least some degree. But within a mere 20-minute drive of where Higgins sat, there were the slums of no man's land, virtually lawless, with its own underground economy, such as it was. There wasn't any way of knowing how many people lived there, much less who they were, or the details of their lives. It was the same in much of the rest of the country. In Jennifer Stone's case, her file was more complete than most, except for the details of her personal life. That bothered Higgins. Everything about Jennifer Stone bothered him. The way she'd gotten to him bothered him especially. He was intensely attracted to her from the very first moment he set eyes upon her. But he had not been prepared for the incredibly powerful surge of chemistry that had occurred between them. Even now, he wanted her so badly that he ached. And in the coldly rational part of his brain, alarms were going off all over the place. Control had always been of paramount importance to him. And now, for the first time, he had lost it. He had lost control of the project when Stalker ran amok, and now it seemed he was losing control of his personal life as well. His secretary buzzed him.
Dr. Stone to see you, sir.
Send her in, please. The door opened and Jennifer came in. You wanted to see me? Yes, Jennifer, come in, please. Belatedly, he realized that he still had her file on the desk in front of him. He closed it and put it away in his desk, but her eyes, or her intuition, were too quick for him. Is that my file? Higgins nodded. That's not really fair, is it, sir? She said. I know almost nothing about you. I know, Jennifer. Please sit down. She sat across from the desk from him and crossed her extremely attractive legs. Higgins tried hard not to stare at them, but he could already feel his blood pressure rising rapidly. We need to talk, he said.
Look, about last night, she started.
She blushed.
I just wanted you to know that...
Jennifer?
No, let me finish. This isn't very easy for me. I mean, I don't even know if you're married or not.
I'm not.
Well, I'm glad to hear that anyway. I hate you to think that I...
Jennifer, look,
I just wanted you to know that that what happened between us is going to be a problem for you. I've already made out my resignation,
she said quickly. You want to resign? He asked, surprised.
No, I don't want to resign, she said, but I'm well aware that this is a sensitive situation and we're both under a great deal of stress as it is without... She took a deep breath. Without personal pressures getting in the way, so if it will make matters easier for me to leave, I will.
I don't want you to leave, he said. For one thing, you've got the perfect qualifications for this job, and it would be very difficult to replace you on such short notice. For another, I'd like very much for you to stay. For personal reasons, he paused. I must admit that I wasn't prepared for what happened between us last night. But I want you to know I don't regret it for a moment. I've been thinking about it all day. She moistened her lips nervously and looked down at the floor.
I don't know what came over me, she said. I've never done anything like that before.
Well, neither have I, said Higgins. But I really don't see any reason for us to feel guilty or awkward about it. We're both consenting adults, for God's sakes, and things like that happen. We've both been under a lot of stress and in the excitement of everything that was.
You don't understand, she said. What I meant was that I've never, well, I never.
She blushed and her voice trailed off. The cool, totally professional, efficient, and unflappable Jennifer Stone suddenly seemed like an embarrassed schoolgirl. For a moment, Higgins didn't understand what she was talking about, but then it dawned on him, and he stared at her with astonishment. You mean, are you seriously telling me that you've never had a man before? She recovered some of her composure and looked him directly in the eyes.
You are the first, she said.
I can't believe it. A woman like you. Haven't you ever been in love?
I've never had the time for it, she said.
Well, that's not entirely true. I didn't want to make the time. I've had plenty of opportunities, and there have been men I've felt attracted to, but I didn't want to complicate my life. So that explained why there was nothing about her personal life in the dossier, thought Higgins. The lady was the ultimate workaholic. She didn't have a personal life.
I'd set certain goals for myself, she continued, and I didn't want anything to get in the way of my accomplishing them. I've observed that men tend to get in the way a lot. I'm not unaware of my looks, but when you look the way I do, men often don't take you very seriously. And I've got no room in my life for a man who won't take me seriously. I've basically never had time in my life for a man, period. My work means everything to me, Oliver, ever since I was old enough to read and find out what the world was like before the war. These days, most people are content just to survive, or to grab as much for themselves as they can. I've never been satisfied with that. I wanted to change things, and I didn't want to end up married with children, worrying about what kind of rotten world they were growing up in, not knowing where the chances would be. I wanted to do something about it, so I avoided personal relationships because they just didn't fit in.
You threw yourself into your work instead, said Higgins.
And I've never regretted it,
she replied.
But after last night,
she sighed and shook her head.
I can easily intellectualize what happened last night. A new environment, different from anything that I've been used to, an exciting, challenging new job, the sort of thing I'd worked for all my life, an element of danger, the stress, the anxiety, the thrill of the discovery relating to that backup engram program, the adrenaline flow and being alone with you. And you're not by any means an unattractive man. I've been sublimating my sex drive all these years, a virgin at the age of 34, and it all suddenly exploded. But understanding why it happened is one thing. The emotions that go with it or something else. Again,
I know exactly what you mean, said Higgins.
The intelligent and logical thing to do, she said, since you don't want me to resign and we're going to have to work together, is for us to accept what happened like mature adults and to write it off to a brief fling and simply let it go at that.
Higgins pursed his lips and nodded. Except there's just one problem, he said. I don't know about you, but I guess I'm not feeling too intelligent and logical right now, because I don't really want to let it go with that. Jennifer Stone took a deep breath and let it out in a long and heavy sigh.
Neither do I, she said. I guess that means we've got a problem.
It doesn't have to be one, Higgins said. I think we're both professional enough not to let our personal feelings get in the way of what we have to do. And if it starts to become a problem, then I think we're both intelligent enough to admit it to ourselves and break it off with no hard feelings.
It could get sticky, she said.
It won't be, if you won't. Look, Jennifer, we don't really know each other very well, but we know we've got at least one thing in common. We're both married to our work. We should be able to respect that in each other.
I'd like to think so, she said.
Would you have dinner with me tonight?
I can't. The lab still isn't ready. I have to work, she smiled. You see what I mean? I told you that personal relationships get in the way.
He grinned. You have to eat.
I usually have a sandwich sent down from the cafeteria.
A drink after hours, then.
We're already both working on too little sleep.
Well, make it a short one. And you can have another look at Steele's backup program.
That's a dirty trick, she said with a smile. You know I've been dying to spend more time with it.
Hey, I'm a spook, he said with a shrug. We specialize in dirty tricks. She sighed, defeated.
Okay, you win. I'll come up after I'm through for the day downstairs. but only on one condition. What's that? She grinned. Can we use the couch this time? My back's still sore from that damn desk. Stalker hadn't slept since he broke out of the project labs at the federal building. He wasn't tired. He was driven by a restless energy, and while his brutish followers camped down in the darkness, huddled around a fire they built on the tracks, Stalker roamed the abandoned tunnels, trying to make some sense of his existence. He did not recall being Mick Taylor. Mick Taylor's thoughts and memories flickered through his mind like brief electronic discharges, but then got lost once more as bits and pieces of his engrams from other personalities came flooding in to confuse him. He didn't know that something had gone disastrously wrong with the programming of his data engram matrix. All he knew was that his mind was in turmoil, and he vaguely remembered having died. His computer mind was a jumbled confusion of overlapping memories and experiences. There was no way he could understand what had happened to him. He did not know that his persona was a blend of Mick Taylor's identity, downloaded from his damaged brain, and what Dr. Gates had called ancillary data, mental engrams recorded from other test subjects in the Project Download experiments. Somehow, something had gone wrong when the program had been assembled, or perhaps the problem had occurred when the engram matrix had been loaded to his cybernetic brain. There was no way of knowing exactly what had triggered the malfunction. But somehow the ancillary data engrams had become disassociated from the matrix, and Stalker had become a paranoid, homicidal schizophrenic. He continually relived fragments of his own and others' lives. He could still feel the agony as he stumbled from the wreckage of the Strike Force pursuit vehicle, his body torn and bleeding, wreathed in flames, and then the second explosion came before he could get more than several steps away from the burning hulk. The force of the blast had picked him up and hurled him through the air. Hot shrapnel peppered him, slicing into his body and his brain. And the last thing he remembered thinking before he slipped away was steel. He knew that steel had brought him to that place where it all happened. He knew that steel had left him there to die. He did not remember that steel had gone into the abandoned, crumbling storefront in no man's land to meet with Ice, a man with a contract on his life because he had resisted Victor Borodini's takeover of the skulls. He did not remember that it was Borodini's hired assassins who had blown him up and rained fire into the abandoned storefront, shooting steel down with their primary while their primary target escaped. In his twisted reasoning, he only knew that Steele was responsible for what had happened to him, and he believed that it was Steele's fault they had come back from the dead, part human, part machine, tormented by a cybernetic brain whose programming had gone haywire. A part of Stalker didn't want to live. He longed for sweet oblivion, a surcease from the constant confusion of images and memories that plagued him, images and memories that he could not reconcile. He heard voices talking to him, voices from a dim past that held no meaning for him. He could not shut them up. He did not want to live like this, but another part of him was driven by a strong, relentless fighter's urge for survival. He was being pulled in separate directions. Conflicting emotions raged within him like a firestorm. He knew that they were hunting him, but that didn't worry him. He was able to monitor their every move. He had been designed with both broadcast and receiving capabilities, and a scrambler circuit had been built into his brain, enabling him to instantly decode police and government transmissions. They didn't know he had that capability, and it was a simple matter for him to stay several steps ahead of them. He had learned from monitoring the police transmission that Steele's daughter had been kidnapped by somebody named Borodini. He had a dim recollection of that name. He also had a vague memory of a young and pretty teenage girl named Corey. The police were looking for her. Perhaps he could find her first. They had stayed up late, waiting, but there was still no word from Rick Borodini or his father. Raven finally went to sleep, but Steele didn't want to come to bed. He didn't want to sleep. Sleep would only bring the nightmares once again. Nightmares that could, he realized, be a grim harbinger of what could yet become of him. It frightened him to think that what had happened to Mick Taylor could occur to him. And if that was in the cards, there was nothing he could do about it. He felt helpless in the face of what was happening. He didn't have a clue as to where Corey was. He thought of Janice and the anxiety and the guilt she must be suffering. And in spite of all the hurt that she had brought him, his heart went out to her. And he thought of Mick, or the creature that had once been Mick, and the knowledge that there was nothing he could do to help his old friend and partner twisted in him like a knife. His orders were to neutralize him, to take him out, to kill him. He tried to tell himself that if their positions were reversed, he'd want Mick to do the same for him. But that thought didn't give him any comfort. His thoughts returned to Corey. Would Borodini kill her just to get back at him? If so, then she was undoubtedly dead already. But he didn't believe that Borodini would take his satisfaction so cheaply. Victor Borodini was not that kind of man. He was the kind of man who'd want his full pound of flesh. He would not kill Corey. She was too valuable a tool to use against his enemy. By now, with the police bust of his warehouse, Victor Borodini had to know that Steele knew he had his daughter. The son of a bitch is making me sweat, thought Steele. With the news media going wild over the stalker story, Borodini would know about that too. He'd take full advantage of it, only Steele did not know exactly how. Would he play a waiting game and see if Stalker did his work for him? Or would he wait for just the right moment to put the pressure on, forcing him to choose between his duty and his daughter? One way or another, Steele thought, you had to act. You had to do something. He picked up the phone and called building security. This is Steele, he said. I'm going out. I don't know when I'll be back. But I'll leave strict orders that neither Raven nor my son are to leave the building under any circumstances. Use reasonable force to detain them if necessary. But they are not to leave. I want to be sure that they're safe. Is that perfectly understood?
Yes, sir. I'll see to it that your instructions are passed on to all personnel.
Thank you. He hung up the phone, then went over to the arms locker and started to put on his battle gear. He was through playing a waiting game, waiting to hear from Borodini, waiting to see where Stalker would strike next. He'd take the fight to him. He had to be hiding somewhere underneath the city in the maze of subway tunnels. He'd search through every foot of them until he found him, no matter how long it took. And then he turned his attention to the Borodinis, assuming he survived. End of chapter.